Good afternoon. Oh, yeah, it is morning. Whatever time is. Good morning. I realize my computer's on East Coast time. It's cool. We'll do a call to order. I'm going to do the land acknowledgement. I promise I've done this before. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washoe, Numu, Northern Paiute, Niue, Western Shoshone, and Niue, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we stand in intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. Winner, please take roll.
Chair Brown?
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Brager?
Here.
Regent Goicoechea?
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Regent Brager, will you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 933-5568-7402 and passcode 555555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
Not at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno? Nope.
Any public comment? Not seeing any.
Thank you, Regent. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas?
Good morning. My name is Dr. Sandra Cosgrove, and I'm a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada. And right now, I'm co-chairing an ad hoc faculty senate first-year experience committee with Luis Ortega, who you'll hear from in just a minute. Our committee believes that we have an urgent need at CSN to reimagine our first-year experience program because of the changes in our student population and changes in the economy. Our students now are very different from students just 10 years ago, and our state of the economy is very different than even 5 years ago. Our students coming directly from CCSD need a lot of focused attention in their first semester to connect them to our wraparound resources. And most of our students actually need a better, more stable job right away before they can buckle down and get their first degree. So we're working to connect all of our students to our resources and to the workforce side of the house from day one. Luis and I wanted to let you know that you'll be hearing from us about our recommendations through the CSN Faculty Senate, and we will have an ask eventually about adding a new workforce category to our degree sheets. Thank you.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Luis Ortega, and I am a counselor at CSN, and also the chair of the Department of Counseling and Retention Services. In May 2024, I graduated from UNLV with my PhD in higher education and educational psychology. My dissertation title was Understanding the Role of First-Year Experience Courses in the Persistent Retention and Completion of Latinx HSI Community College Students. My research topic concentrated on exploring the barriers students face in completed higher education. This is some of the literature review findings, which I cannot go in detail, and also a quick overview. The enrollment of Latinx students in higher education is about 3.4 million right now. nearly half of them, 46% of them, enroll in community colleges. As you know, 40% of our students at CSN identify as Hispanic. Graduation rate at community colleges are 39% nationally, but at CSN it's 18%. We are 21% below the graduation average. First-year experience courses are designed to support students transition to college and prepare them to successfully incorporating skills related to time management, studying, and also get familiar with college environment and campus resources. So here are some of my findings that I'm going to go real quick. 90% of the participants were first-generation students. 66% of them were working part-time or full-time, which speaks about their financial struggles. 50% of them wanted to transfer to a four-year college. Most of the participants experienced mental health struggles due to many barriers that they were facing in the first year. FYE's first-year experience courses provided a space for social integration and social development, which is called social capital. Most participants agreed that FYE should be a mandatory class in the first or second semester. The FYE course that provided confidence and changed the students' mindset to continue their academics. So here's my whole overall conclusion. My dissertation conclusion was that it provided the evidence that FYEs do bridge the gap of knowledge and persistence among Latinx students, but also the establishment of an FYE must be a collaborative, involving faculty, administrators, and most crucially, the student voices. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
Yes, we do have one caller. Caller with the phone number ending in 710, please press *6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes to address the committee. They're not unmuting, Chair. I think that's all we have at this time.
All right, thank you so much. We'll move on to minutes. The committee will consider approval of the minutes from the December 4th meeting. Do I have a motion?
Motion to approve, Risa Del Carlo here.
Second.
Thank you. I have a first from Regent Del Carlo, a second from Regent Brager. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Abstentions. Okay, thank you. The minutes have been accepted. We're going to move on to the chair's report, and I'm going to take just a few minutes to read some prepared remarks. So, as we convene for today's first meeting of the Workforce Committee under our new schedule, I want to express my gratitude to each of you and your commitment and dedication to this journey. The decision to increase our meeting frequency is a strategic one, aimed at providing us with the necessary time to delve deeply into critical gaps within our system structure. I'm profoundly thankful for the hard work and dedication of our staff, who embraced these changes with enthusiasm, but I just want to say thank you. I know this is a lot of extra work. Your efforts are the backbone of our progress, and they set the stage for the meaningful work we're about to undertake. As we move forward, I want to extend a preemptive thank you to the faculty and staff across our institutions. In the coming months, we will be asking you to engage in a series of changes. These adjustments will be aimed at streamlining our operations and enhancing our overall strength of our system. While change can be challenging, it is essential to our growth and efficiency. Please be assured that these changes are carefully considered and your input will be asked for. They are designed not just for short-term benefits, but to lay a robust foundation for long-term success and sustainability. Our goal is to create a system that is not only more responsive to the needs of today, but also anticipate the demands of tomorrow. I hope we can approach the coming months with open minds and a shared commitment to not only identify the gaps that challenge us, but also forge the pathway that leads us to a stronger, more unified future. Thank you again for your dedication and journey with me on this critical work. Next, we're going to move to agenda item number 4, and invite Vice Chancellor Academic Affairs and Academic and Student Affairs Daniel Archer to the podium to go over our Credit for Prior Learning Action Plan.
Okay, sorry, we will start this over again. So Daniel Archer here to talk about the Credit for Prior Learning Action Plan. And before I get into that, though, I do want to emphasize that we have talked about this a few different times here recently. We talked about it at the December workforce meeting briefly here. It came up during the strategic plan presentation in January. It's also in the strategic plan document here, so this shouldn't be really a surprise to anyone at this point here. As we dive into this, I want to start on more of a positive note here and really recognize that we're not starting from scratch here. We have a really strong foundation to sort of build upon. And that foundation is based on our Common Core numbering system here. So you see we have a system in place that standardizes course prefixes and numbers. So you'll see the list there. English Composition 1 is an example. Is sort of coded or classified as ENG 101, and that's throughout our entire system at all of our institutions. Same thing for English Composition 2, English 102, Computer Science 1 is CS 135, and then Financial Accounting is ACC 201 here. So our courses have a common identifier. It's a standard label. It's sort of a universal tag that is used throughout our system here. If you take Financial Accounting, again, which is ACC 201, you'll see that ACC 201 is the standard label in our course catalogs. If someone wanted to look up a course description, they would find that in the course catalogs under ACC 201. You'll see ACC 201 is a standard label in our class schedules that are posted online. So when students are wanting to enroll in classes and they want to take accounting or financial accounting, they would see it classified under ACC 201. You'll see ACC 201 also is a standard label that's on academic transcripts, and once a student has completed a course, it's posted on the transcript, and it'll say ACC 201 financial accounting, and it'll have the grade on it. So again, this is a standard labeling system. It's a universal recognition that really applies across the board here. So if someone takes ACC 201 at Institution A, they transfer to Institution B, ACC 201 will transfer, and if ACC 201 is needed for a degree requirement at the receiving institution, which is Institution B, obviously, it'll satisfy that degree requirement without question because we have the same label, we have the same nomenclature, we're all kind of speaking the same language at the end of the day, which is a really foundational tenet of being a good system. So, again, I want to reiterate that we have a really strong foundation with the Common Core numbering. This has been around since 2000, so some really good work has been done in that space here. But I also want to get into our second layer, and that's primarily why we're here today, which is the Credit for Prior Learning. You'll see that Credit for Prior Learning, you'll see according to the Council for Adult and Experiential Learning, which is otherwise known as CALE, it's a term for various methods that colleges, universities, and other education or training providers use to evaluate learning that has occurred outside of a traditional academic environment. So for today's purposes, we're going to focus a lot on nationally recognized exams and how those equate to college credit here. It's a really simple premise here. Instead of taking the full semester course where you take a class for 15 weeks and then you take a final exam, you essentially take one exam. If you perform well on that exam, there's opportunities to earn college level credit here. And we look at this from a system point of view. It's very important to point out that there are cases in our system where we have sort of system-wide balance and the credit for prior learning space here. So in other words, there are cases where students earn the same score on a nationally recognized exam and it results in the same credit at all seven of our institutions. We certainly have cases of that. And when that is the case, we have balance, we have fairness, we have consistency, we have simplicity, we have clarity, all the things I think at the end of the day that we want as a system. But there are other cases, though, where we have imbalance here when it comes to credit for prior learning. Just one example. We have a case where one institution awards 3 hours of credit for earning a specific score on a specific exam, and then another institution awards 0 hours of credit for earning the same score on the exact same exam. Similarly, we have another case where one institution awards 3 hours of credit for a specific score on a specific exam, and then another institution awards 6 hours of credit for the same score on the exact same exam here. So there's certainly some cases of imbalance here, and as you see this, I think a lot of you are probably thinking, you know, where are the details, where are the specifics here, what are the, sort of the pragmatic examples of where this is going on in our system. And if you're thinking along those lines, I think you're headed in the right direction. And we're going to get there in just a second. But before we do that, I do want to sort of reemphasize this idea of imbalance and sort of inconsistencies. And I encourage you to keep this image in your head of this sort of imbalance piece here. And I also encourage you to think about this through the student perspective and through the parent perspective, even, because when students see these imbalances, it creates mixed messages. It creates confusion. It creates frustration. So this is a real issue for students and for families. But it's also an issue for our K-12 system, because the reality is our high school counselors and our teachers are helping students navigate these processes here. And when you have practices that differ among institutions, it complicates their efforts and makes the navigation significantly more difficult here. So institutions were never told to align their credit for prior learning, so it makes sense that they haven't. These things don't typically happen organically. So it's not really a problem of wrongdoing, but it certainly does create challenges, but also creates an opportunity to do things better for our students. And so in terms of the focus here today, there's four areas we're going to focus on when it comes to credit for prior learning today. Advanced placement, which is otherwise known as AP, the college level examination program, military training, and then high school technical courses and assessments, the latter of which really applies at our two-year colleges. So again, I want to reemphasize that our strategic plan calls for developing system-wide approaches to credit for prior learning, so we're not kind of pulling this out of thin air here. So we're going to lay out where some of the inconsistencies are and then also lay out our plan going forward here. So I want to start out with advanced placements, again, otherwise known as AP. Most of you all are probably well aware of this, but this is set up in such a way where high school students take an advanced high school course with college-level rigor. So again, we're talking about high school students taking an advanced high school course with college-level rigor. They typically take this in their senior year. Then at the end of the year, the students who take an AP class have an opportunity to take an AP exam. And you'll see the numbers spelled out here for you. Over 25,000 students took an AP course in Nevada in 2024, and then we had over 42,000 AP exams administered in Nevada in 2024 here. So we're not talking about a handful of students here or there. We're talking about thousands upon thousands of students taking this exam each and every year. And I do want to point out that this is the most common form of credit for prior learning where we're talking about the traditional population. We're talking about those between the ages of 18 and 24. This is certainly the biggest credit for prior learning area. And so in terms of how this works, the determination of whether credit is awarded is based on AP scoring structure here. And so when a student earns a 3, a 4, or a 5, again, they earn a 3, or 4, or a 5, our current board policy states that a student shall receive college credit. So again, if a student earns a 3, a 4, or a 5, our policy specifies that they shall receive college credit. So we require that credit be awarded, but we don't specify what the credit is. And that's really the root of our problem. Again, we require that credit be awarded, but we don't specify what that credit is. And as a result of that, we have a lot of inconsistencies in the system here. Just one example, just jumping into AP English Language and Composition. This is the highest taken AP exam nationwide by a very large margin. So we're looking at a test here that certainly has a broad reach here. And so we're looking at students who earned a 3, and we're also looking at students who earned a 4 or 5. The good news is when we look at this on the left side here and looking at those who had a 3, scored a 3 score, you'll see that all of our institutions are awarding the exact same credit. They're all awarding English Composition 1, English 101, 3 hours. We're all on the same page there. But when a student earns a 4 or 5, you'll see there are some differences. You'll see that 6 out of 7 of our institutions are awarding credit for both English Composition 1 and English Composition 2. So they're awarding 6 hours of total credit there. That leaves just one institution because that's only 6 out of 7. So we have one institution that is only awarding credit for English Composition 1. So obviously there are some incongruities here. I talked to an AP English teacher over the summer that kind of described this as a moving target. I think that's a fair analogy here because we are one system, but we have two different credit possibilities for the same result. Again, we're one system, but we have two different credit possibilities for the exact same result here. And the other thing worth noting is looking at this through an affordability lens, because if I am a student, or if I'm a parent for that matter, and my son or daughter has to take that English composition too. Let's say they scored a 5, but they go to the institution that only gives you 3 credit hours. They're going to have to go on and take that English composition 2 course, and that's going to be over $1,000 in tuition and fees. So that adds up pretty quickly there. So I think it's important to look at it from an affordability lens as well here. At the end of the day here, we have these common numbered courses that are there, but we don't consistently award the same credit based on AP performance here. And just another example here, looking at AP Computer Science Principles here. If a student earns a 3, we're going to look at that first year, and you'll see that 4 institutions say that equates to elective credit. And then you'll see here that 2 institutions say it's intro to computing. It's CS105. And then you have another institution that says it's intro to programming. So again, we have 3 different possibilities for earning a 3 based on the misalignment within our institutions there. Let's say if a student earns a 4 or 5 here, you'll see that 6 out of 7 institutions are awarding the exact same credit. So in other words, they're not awarding any additional credit based on that higher score here. You'll see, though, 1 institution does what 3 institutions do, and they do award that elective credit. But in addition to that elective credit, when a student earns a 4 or 5, they are also awarding credit for Computer Science 1 and Computer Science 2. So in other words, you have 1 institution awarding 9 hours, you have everyone else only awarding 3. So again, we're one system, we have 1 standardized exam that can result in the 4 possible credit outcomes here. So again, that's just AP. Also want to cover CLEP here. This is the college level examination program. So we're talking about a different test now. This is very similar to AP here. It's a nationally recognized exam. The main difference, though, is that CLEP exams are not tied to a high school course. These are exams that are open to anyone. It can be taken at test centers on our NC campuses here. There is not a prescribed requisite score for policy for awarding credit. So there's not anything in our policy right now about CLEP exams. However, there is sort of a national norm that's out there that says a score of 50 or more leads to college credit. You've seen a lot of states and systems adopt that as a policy. We have not. But again, there's a national norm that's out there that states that a score of 50 or higher will lead to college credit. So just to explore CLEP here, let's look at principles of accounting, that CLEP exam. That's something that's a little bit more workforce oriented. Let's say a student earns a 50 or higher on that. In terms of how that plays out in our system here, you'll see that we have 1 institution that awards credit for financial accounting and managerial accounting, so they're getting 6 hours. Then we have another institution that only awards credit for financial accounting. I think it's actually 2, excuse me. And then we have another institution that awards general elective credit, so they don't give any accounting credit. They award general elective credit. And then we have 3 institutions that do not give any credit at all. So, again, 1 system, 1 exam, 4 different credit outputs here. The goalposts literally move from one institution to the next. So when someone calls and asks us at the system office, what does a student need to, or I guess what credit would be awarded if a student earns a 50 or higher, the answer should not be it depends on where you go. And it should not be a case where we're saying if there are 4 different scenarios here, that the answer really should be you're going to get credit for this specific course and you're going to get X number of credit hours, and that should be consistent across the board. That's really what we're wanting to do to kind of embrace this system model. And so some other pieces here, the military training, the typical practice here is to award credit for basic training. Usually that's physical education credit, but there are also opportunities to award credits in additional areas for their military occupational specialty. The career training they had in the military could also equate to collegiate credit. So as an example, maybe they trained to be a military police officer. That can result in police science or criminal justice credit, or maybe they trained to be a cybersecurity analyst. That could result in cybersecurity or computer science training. You'll see here by statute and policy, both institutions are required to publish an inventory of the military credit that it awards to students here. So again, that's something that is required just in terms of getting into some of the differences here. We're just looking at basic training right now here, and this is just multiple institutions you'll see are awarding up to 4 credit hours. Another one awards 15 here, so obviously some differences there. It's next to impossible to probably standardize all of the military credit because there literally are thousands of possibilities. But we certainly want to look at basic training here. I think we also want to work with our registrars to identify the most common training that they see that come in on the military transcripts. The American Council on Education, otherwise known as ACE, is another valuable resource here. They can help us identify the military experiences that are most frequently recommended for college credit here, because they issue guidance and recommendations, so we can work with ACE as well. But certainly, there's opportunities for us to focus on what moves the needle the most, and really, again, focusing on those experiences that are most frequently recommended for college credit here, and building some alignment within the military space. And just the last piece, I want to talk about career technical education, CTE. This is set up in such a way where we partner with high schools across the state, and students will take these during their junior and senior year. They have to pass specific courses. They have to have a 3.0 or better. Then they have to pass a couple of exams, and then they're able to earn collegiate credit in different areas. These are just some of them. Again, just looking at computer science and welding, IT networking, and so forth here. So there are some inconsistencies that are there that we've noted. It's work that we've done here. So very important to note that some of the introductory and foundational courses will differ. So it's not quite as clean and seamless, but like a welding one, for example. A welding one class may be 4 hours at one institution, but it may be 6 hours at another here. So again, this is not quite as seamless and clean as talking about English Composition One, which is a 3-hour course everywhere. But I think there's some opportunities to look at some of these inconsistencies and build some continuity there in the CTE space as well here. So in terms of how we move forward, so we are working on policy revisions right now. We have some dated language in there. We have some language that refers to credit for prior learning as advanced standing. That's kind of an old school term for that. It's inconsistent with contemporary higher education nomenclature, so we're working on that. There's some restrictive policies in there that really impede innovation and really, I think, hinder student success. There's a policy that states you cannot accept more than 16 semester credits from non-traditional sources. We really need to get rid of that. So some work is being done there. It's a kind of an unnecessary restriction here. And we also will map out our process for establishing system-wide credit for prior learning here. This will involve faculty coming together to review CPL and issue recommendations about system-wide credit here. So we are working on that policy right now, and we plan to share that with stakeholders here. We want to make sure that there are no surprises in doing this work. We want to make sure that no one says that they never had a chance to weigh in, so we want to be really intentional and purposeful about putting that out there and providing opportunities for people to provide feedback. So other pieces here in terms of beyond that, we do want to run this through both the ARSA, which is the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee, as well as through the workforce here, because the reality is that it really touches on both. There's some credit for prior learning that is more academic, such as English and history, and there's some that's more workforce-oriented, so we want to be intentional and personal about working with both groups and covering both bases here. So we will see this go through both committees here. We plan to bring you a polished, finished-up policy in June, and then the fall plan to work with faculty on establishing the system-wide standards for AP CLEP and International Baccalaureate. And then in the spring, we plan to flip our efforts toward developing system-wide approaches to CPL for common military training and for high school technical assessments here. And so that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Vice Chancellor Archer. What I really wanted to say before I open it up for questions and comments is that, first, thank you for doing all this background work and putting it in a format. I think I like the Lego pieces. When we started talking with Natalie Brown, who I see is in Reno today, and you guys just kept telling me all about all these different inconsistencies, and then we would talk to students and they would talk to us about their trajectory and how these little inconsistencies created a compounding effect. So I just think it's really great that we are getting ready to tackle this stuff. I wanted to ask real quick, I mean, clearly students can shop around for credits at this point, right? I mean, your example of military credit, we'll just start there since it was so drastic. if somebody enrolls in the institution that gives 15 credits, there's nothing to stop them to then transfer to a second institution that would have only given them 4 and taken the 15 credits with them, right?
Well, I think you bring up a good point. I think that's the other challenge. This is Daniel Archer, by the way. I should identify myself. But I think that's the other issue. I think there are also inconsistencies in terms of recognizing credit for prior learning. I think we need to get to a point that we treat it like transfer work. I think some institutions do that and some don't. So that's another issue, and so you're on top of it.
Yeah, and I'll just say the second thing to that. I also think that there's – I think this is a multi-problem, right? It's a problem for the students, but it's also a problem for the institutions if you really look at it. I think the one piece that people fail to recognize is staff time, and that's a big line item in anyone's budget. So if you are – and I'm using big numbers just to exaggerate the point, but if 100 students enroll in Institution A because they're going to get 15 credits, and that institution says, oh, I have 100 students. I need to do wraparound services. I need counselors. I need to hire a new faculty person because I have 100 students. They do that, and then those 100 students transfer to the second institution that would have only given them 4. That second institution is not prepared for those 100 students because they didn't know that they needed those wraparound services. They didn't know they needed the staff. So potentially we're looking at, and this is probably happening on a micro level, but compounded over all these different colleges and, you know, academic areas and workforce areas, it's probably adding up to quite a few dollars in wasted staff time and resources at that first institution because they hired everyone that will go unused, and the second institution is not prepared, so they're not ready for these students. So I also think I want to take it also 30,000 feet out, right? It's not just about the individual student that we're going to make this for, but it's about our health of our system and, like, the money that we will save, and it's not just about money. I realize that education is important, but being prepared and being able to show up for the students when they show up for classes.
No, I think you're right on. Yeah.
So I wanted to just make that point because that is another piece to this, is like it is also going to make our system healthier. I want to acknowledge we have Regent Del Carlo on this committee, who is the chair of ARSA, and I also sit on that. So to Vice Chancellor Archer's point, in June when we bring this up, I'm going to hopefully have a joint meeting, given that most of us overlap. And I know that she has a question, but she's walking away. So we'll get back to her. But I did want to acknowledge that we do have the chair of ARSA on here to make this a more streamlined approach. Regent Brigger, please.
Thank you, Susan Brigger, for the record. So, and I don't want to belabor it because we could chat another time. How do you make it at the point of time, and I know I'm new on this committee, but I serve on the Governor's Workforce Development Board, so it kind of helps a lot. I'm going to try to get Heather over there, or Regent Brown. So the unequitable situation of it, that not all students know how to delve in and look at every campus to find out where they can get the most credits. So I feel like, where do we eventually have a, what do I want to call it, somewhere they can go that shows where they can get that? Because it's totally not fair. I think that Regent Brown brought up the most valid point of all, of where they go if they transfer. Like, let's say a lot of our CSN students transfer. But if they can get more credits over here, maybe they're going to try that. So in the future, as we're developing this, there has to be something that's equitable, and maybe more of our campuses. Why is one allowed to do 15 credits and one's allowed to do 6? Why would anybody go to the 6 for the money? You know, I mean, it just... And I don't particularly need an answer right now, but I think it's something we need to, you're welcome to, but look at, to where not all students are, I don't want to use the word educated, but for lack of a better word, formally educated in how they figure it out. Maybe they go to their high school counselor, who are students are underserved there, not their fault, but to the money problems that seem to be there. And even in our system, counselors don't have time. When we have 30,000 students, to work with each individual to say, well, if you went, and they probably might not know, well, if you go to campus A, you're going to get 3 credits, but if you go to campus B, you're going to get 15. Why would anybody go to A? So I just think that's important.
I will say to that, Regent Brown, for the record, that is the crux of what we are trying to solve for. Because you do have some examples of counselors shopping their students around because they know. But then you have, I'll give myself as an example. I passed two AP classes with fives, and I went to UNLV, which gave me 3 credits each. Had I gone to UNR, I would have got 6 credits for both of those classes. At the time, I didn't know. I'm a first-gen student, and I barely knew how to register for classes. But there is a world where I could have enrolled, got my 12 credits, and then transferred back to UNLV. That is the inconsistency, and that is an extra step, because I also want to bring up that step leads to potential problems in registration, right? Like, that's a gap where we might lose a student because they messed up their paperwork or the transfer didn't happen or a myriad of things. It's also just really unnecessary and a duplicative process that is just, if we are a true system, we just shouldn't exist. So thank you for bringing that up, because that is certainly something that we want to tackle, streamline. And on slide 16, this timeline gives us a good marching order of when that will actually happen. And hopefully as a board and as committees, we'll be able to make these votes. Regent Del Carlo, you had a question.
I have several, Chair Brown.
Excellent.
And I'd like to just, first of all, say this is really the crux of what we do. And I am so pleased this is on your agenda. I'm so pleased it's in our strategic plan. And we've been working at this, but we haven't solved it for quite a long time. And so let me start with some of my questions. First thing for you, Chancellor Archer, on the Common Core numbering, are we 100% there? I mean, have we got that one solved? Because when I first came on the board, that's been 8 years ago, we talked about it then. So have we, like, fixed it? It's done? Everything is all aligned?
I think on the Common Core numbering itself, in terms of having the general education courses and having them be paired and using one number, I think we're in really good shape on. I think there's opportunities for more degree alignment where you're actually having the same degree requirements in the same programs to ensure the courses both transfer and apply and satisfy degree requirement at the second institution. So I think in terms of looking at the transfer space, Common Core numbering, we're in good shape. I think the second piece there, and really the second layer, is to align programs to where you have the same requirements, at least for the associate degrees as an example, where you have the first 60 hours kind of aligned. And that way, if someone changes course, then they're still on the exact same plan. The courses are the same. The numbers are the same. Everything really applies in the exact same way as it did at Institution A as it does at Institution B. So we really want to focus more on degree alignment, I think, in the future in terms of some of our transfer efforts here. But I think the Common Core numbering is one thing that works really well and something that NC should be really proud of, because not a lot of systems have done it to this extent.
Okay, so you can pretty much say then that little piece of it is accomplished.
Yes,
right?
It works really well, yes.
Okay, and so I see David Singleton sitting in the back of the room, which I'm really happy to see him, because I don't know if you can see this brochure I'm holding up. It's transfer and articulation. Can you see this brochure? This brochure got put together probably 6 years ago, and it's even got a picture of David here in the brochure. So I'm just really glad we're doing this, and we're getting down deep into it. This was more a broad brush, but you've identified the areas, which is really great. So you said when you were in the first part of your presentation that there's cases of imbalance within ENCHI, and institutions were never asked to align. So have you done a survey yet, or do you know where the non-alignments are, where the most work needs to be done? Have you identified that yet?
Yes, this is Daniel Archer. Yeah, we took inventory. We looked at this, and credit to Dave Singleton here. He did some work over the summer and in the fall on that to kind of outline. And we knew that going in just from anecdotal conversations we've had and feedback we've had from students at different points. So, but, yeah, we have pinpointed the areas. And there are some areas where there is alignment. AP Psychology, for example, is one where everyone is granting 3 hours of credit for introductory psych if someone has a three or better. So there are some cases where there is alignment, but there hasn't been a purposeful, intentional effort for us to come together as a system. It's been kind of an independent thing previously.
Okay, another question here. When we talk about that slide on the advanced placement, I think it's like slide 9, where do we have any statistics on the percentages of students who get a 1 or 2 on their tests, and do we know which classes they are? Do we track, are we going that granular on this?
We only award credit if a student has a 3 or more, so I don't think there's probably a lot done when a student has a 1 or 2. However, we could work with the Nevada Department of Education. They probably have that data. So if you want to get more details on passage rates and things like that, I'm sure we can get that.
I look at that because that would be feedback to, I mean, if these kids take these classes and they're not even passing a 3, is an easy, you know, it should be an easy thing to pass with a 3, 4, or 5. But if you get a 1 or a 2, I mean, what was the purpose of them taking that class? And then on the CLEP, do the students pay to take those, or are they just free for a student to come in and take?
There is a flat fee. I can double check on that to get. I can follow up with you, I should say, on that. But there is a flat fee that they pay, and so that's the issue. Is if they get below a 50 on that, then they're out the money. But that's kind of how it works.
Right.
It's kind of all or nothing.
Okay. I just wondered on that. And then on the last slide on slide 17, the very spring 2025, you said only 16 credits transfer. Is that right? On the CTA, we accept 16 credits?
So we have something that says, let me go back and find that exact piece here. Yeah, so this is something that's focused on the community colleges, where it says policy states that you cannot accept more than 16 semester credits from non-traditional sources. So non-traditional sources, number one, is kind of an ambiguous term, but it's a very restrictive policy here, and I know that's something that the two-year colleges have pointed out to us, and we're going to get rid of it.
Okay, because I was going to say, I do think there's institutions that have accepted more than that, just from presentations we've had. So, yeah, I feel it's very restrictive. And if the student has earned their credits through other means, I mean, our business is getting them through. So I think prior, all the 4 areas that you identified are all worthy of where a student is. I mean, you don't have to start at the beginning when you've got a lot of life experiences. So I'm really glad we're doing this. I mean, this is just so important, and as the chair pointed out, the cost to the students is huge, and that you pointed out that $1,000 to take that credit, those 3 credits. I mean, and I'd like to see us at some point, we can update our little brochure here, because I think this is a really important brochure that we have to tout systemness. This is all about the value of being a system. So I'm just thrilled to work on this, happy to be chair of ARSA and work with Chair Brown, and this is nothing but a win for our students and our system. So thank you so much for this presentation.
Well, thank
you. Thank you, Chair Brown, for your leadership on this.
And this is Daniel. I'll just add that, you know, our goal is to get to a point where we have a system-wide crosswalk that's consistent across the board, where we'll have AP English, and then we'll have, you know, if you get a 3, you're going to get Comp 1. If you get a 4 or 5, you're going to get Comp 1 and Comp 2 and have that apply across the board, and that would be something that we would disseminate with our K-12 partners. We've had really good conversations with NDE. I've really liked working with Joan Ebert. She's been as good as anybody working in that role, and I've been in 3 systems now, and I think they're very receptive to this as well. It's going to make it easier for everybody because they're a really valuable partner in this too. So.
Thank you.
Regent Brown, for the record. I'm glad you said that, because I actually wrote down here, I think once we get our system aligned, then the next step is to go meet with the trustees and have us work together. I know back of house, you guys will be working with the staff over with the state, but I think there's something to this and even the state education board just to make sure it's all streamlined, but we do have to clean up our own house first. So are there any more committee members with Regent Goguchia, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Vice Chancellor Archer. I couldn't help it as I go through this, but are we assured there is parity in the exam process? That really concerns me, especially when we're talking if you get one or two or three or four, and it could mean so much to you. How those exams are administered, is it secure? Are we assured everybody's on the same place there?
Yes, this is Daniel Archer. Yes, there's a number of different assessment methodologies that are used to validate the rigor of these exams. They're nationally recognized, and the data is really clear. The students who are earning threes and fours and fives are outperforming the students who don't have any AP credit by a really large margin. So, yes, I definitely think they're valid and they're substantive exams for sure.
Thank you. I'm just concerned about somebody's got somebody hired in the back room taking exams for them, you know, get a little looseness. So anyway, I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
Well, Regent Goguchia, if you're offering, I'll have you take my next exam.
You don't want many points, do you?
No, but to your point, I do think, and Vice Chancellor Archer mentioned this, in his presentation, that there are some nationwide standards, and we should really embrace them. We should really see how they fold in. There's no reason for us to reinvent the wheel. We are a system, but, you know, seven academic institutions. This is something that we can absolutely AP is one of those. It's just accepted that 3, 4, and 5 is the thing. I think Regent Del Carlo, you asked, so what happens if they get a 1 or 2? They just didn't. It's a standard acceptance that you just don't get, and it's something that students are told at the beginning that you don't get college credit for that. Military service, I think, you know, Vice Chancellor Archer really laid it out, but I think ACE guidelines, like, these are standardized things. We should be, you know, if somebody does cybersecurity in the military, they shouldn't just get 3 credits of PE, in my opinion, and we should really value what that is and make it easy. So I do think that we should embrace more of these national standards. Regent Del Carlo, you said you had another question.
Well, I just wanted to also say, I did get a comment, somebody sent it to me, and I just want to bring it up again. On that 16 credits, I've talked about this before, that really we're looking at enrollments and where can we find students. This demographic cliff is coming, and I've said this before, that I see the low-hanging fruit is all those adult learners out there that need to come back into our institutions, get some up skills, up training, so they can go out and get better wages. And if we could get rid of that, just only 16 credits transferred, this could really, really be a game changer for our adult learners. So I just want to make that point on how just vital it is that we get that policy changed and transfer more credits in. I mean, you go through life, you learn things every day in life. Doesn't mean you were sat in a classroom to learn it, but there's tons of adults out there that are ready to come in and just upskill. And this will really help them a lot. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Regent Del Carlo. Is anybody else on the committee have a question? If not, I will go to non-committee members. I see we have a few other regents. If anybody has a question, please let me know. Seeing and hearing none. Thank you so much, Vice Chancellor Archer. Again, I just want to say this really set the tone for what this committee is going to do and why we're actually doing it. We spent so much of 2024 just examining all the different inconsistencies and talking it through it. And I'm just excited that we've got an incredible committee together that is going to hopefully make some changes with the rest of our board members. All right, we're going to move on to agenda number 5 and ask Assistant Vice Chancellor for Workforce Development and Community Colleges, Natalie Brown, to come to the podium. to share some exciting news about her holistic credit mobility project.
Thank you so much. Natalie Brown, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Workforce Development and Community Colleges, for the record. And it sounds like you are already in the same space as we are for moving forward in some of these streamlining our practices. So I want to start with good morning, Chair Brown, Vice Chair Del Carlo, members of the Workforce Committee. I'm here today to share an exciting opportunity that will significantly improve system-wide student success and workforce development goals. So we're facing a critical challenge in higher education today. Our students increasingly accumulate credits from diverse sources, as you just recently heard in Vice Chancellor Archer's presentation. Military credit, corporate programs, dual enrollment, AP, IB, CLEP, non-credit programs, some at our own NSHE institutions. Yet often those students struggle to transfer and apply these credits effectively. This challenge particularly affects students from disadvantaged backgrounds, creating unnecessary barriers to degree completion and increasing education costs. Today, I want to discuss a $30,000 grant opportunity NSHE was recently awarded that will help us address these challenges through the Holistic Credit Mobility Project, or HCM. This framework, introduced by Ithaca SNR in 2022, represents a fundamental shift in how we approach credit transfer and student success. At its core, HCM focuses on three essential pillars. First, supportive technology that streamlines the credit transfer process. Second, institutional and system-wide policies that ensure seamless credit acceptance. And third, responsive practices that help students maximize their previously earned credits. This framework moves us from an input-based system where credits are often lost in that transfer process to an output-based model that prioritizes student learning and degree completion. So let me share the specifics of this grant opportunity. The project runs from January 2025 to January 2026 with funding from Ascendium Education Group. We'll be working closely with Ithaca SNR as well as Complete College America to develop an action plan for improving this credit mobilization process. We will be participating in virtual and in-person learning sessions, working with and brainstorming solutions with other HCM participants, and creating an HCM playbook that will serve as a model for our system. The benefits to NSHE are meaningful. We'll gain valuable access to expertise from leading organizations in higher education and develop important partnerships in this space. Through this work, we'll be better positioned to improve our credit transfer process from these non-traditional sources. These improvements will contribute to our ongoing efforts to enhance graduation, retention rates, particularly for our underserved students, as well as supporting our strategic plan. Our participation in this initiative will help us build capacity for credit mobility reform. We'll develop scalable, data-informed solutions that align with local and state workforce needs. And our learning priorities as participants in this year-long project will focus on the following four areas. So first will be credit alignment, so identifying those best practices for integrating credits from diverse sources. The second is technology solutions, so implementing sustainable and scalable systems for tracking and evaluating credit mobility. Process development, streamlining student pathways to reduce those inefficiencies and creating that crosswalk that Vice Chancellor Archer mentioned, as well as data analytics, so leveraging insights to drive policy changes and improve student outcomes across the board, all crucial elements in creating an efficient and equitable system. So in closing, this grant represents more than just funding. It's an opportunity for NSHE to strengthen our foundation and advance our progress towards becoming a leader in credit mobility. Your support in implementing this project and aligning it with our statewide education and workforce goals is crucial. By embracing holistic credit mobility, we can transform the student experience, increase completion rates, and foster a more equitable and accessible higher education system. And thank you for your time, and I welcome any and all questions.
Thank you so much, Regent Brown, for the record. First, you know, I said it at the top, but just thank you so much for all of your work. Just huge shout out to Natalie. She actually went out and got this grant. and was able to, I think this is your second grant in like 6 months, so she's got a great track record. And just this little extra help to actually get us through the finish line is like so appreciative. And I wanted to open it up to anybody on the committee to see if they have any questions. So Natalie, Assistant Vice Chancellor Brown, what do you need from this committee to make success, make it successful? What do you see as our involvement?
Natalie Brown, for the record. Thank you for that question. At this point, we will be having some of our first initial conversations with the group next week. And one of the greatest supports that this group can provide is really being that sounding board as we move forward and developing what, you know, these goals are going to look like. Because we're so early in that process, we're still brainstorming and ideating which pieces we're going to be utilized to support best, not only in some of the goals as identified by the Workforce Committee, but also where we can leverage this grant opportunity for the NC strategic plan overall. So as we move through that process, being as closely connected and communicative with this board and any ideas that you all have, we are open to, you know, hearing and seeing where we can bring those ideas forward throughout this year-long process.
Thank you so much. And just for the record, I would like the legislators to know that we are taking it upon ourselves to help with the matriculation. And thanks to our staff for finding this additional resource, because I do think that it will help with our moving people through the pipeline and getting them into the workforce, which is, at the end of the day, we are the workforce pipeline for the state. And this is just another example of how awesome our staff is for going out above and beyond to help us get there. Well, thank you so much. This is really exciting, and I look forward to working with you guys on this. Now we're going to move to agenda item number 6, DRI workforce development efforts. And I just want to say, you know, to the first couple agenda items, we're talking about the 6 academic institutions, but I'm so happy to have my favorite institution at the podium, because you guys do add so much value to the, and we'll, I don't want to give anything away in your slides, but you do so much for the state and our system as a whole. So, please.
Thank you very much, Regent Brown. For the record, Vic Etemizian, Vice President for Research at DRI. I'm really pleased to be with you here this morning to kick off the presentation we have on workforce development K-12. And I hope I'll be able to convey along with my colleagues that what the activities are that DRI does in this space are varied and interesting and also highly impactful. So at DRI, we really basically, the focus of our work is understanding how people interact with the natural world. And we do this through kind of, our motto is researching how humans impact the environment and how the environment impacts humans. And in most cases, we do this by through a number of externally funded projects, several hundred as a matter of fact. And in most cases, or in many cases, we have those projects that have a workforce K-12 STEM education component. We also have some projects that are specifically dedicated to those tasks. And you'll be hearing from some of my colleagues very shortly about some of those. One that I wanted to draw your attention to, which is not specifically a workforce K-12 project, but which does have that component, is the Southwest Sustainability Innovation Engine, or SWISE, as it is affectionately called. And this is basically a three-state project, a three-state regional partnership, and is led by ASU, DRI, UNLV, and the University of Utah. And it's a little bit different from your traditional research project, because the focus here is on basically building up an innovation ecosystem that brings in startups, as well as multinationals and NGOs, people from the private sector and governmental organizations, and basically facilitates the transfer of innovation from our universities, from our smart people, to the marketplace. And ideally, this is used for the advancement of regional goals and sustainability, having to do with areas of water sustainability and energy, as well as carbon use. So we're currently in the second year of this. It's received $15 million so far. And if we are able to meet our goals, and then funding is also available, there's a potential for an additional $145 million over the following 8 years, which is a terrific injection of resources into our tri-state region that will go to support the work in these areas of sustainability. One component of that is a workforce development K through 12 STEM component that basically starts with obviously kindergarten and then goes all the way through certificate programs as well as PhD training. So that'd be a fantastic boon to that particular effort. So with that project highlighted, I'd like to actually pass this off to my colleague who's joining from another location, Megan Collins.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Megan Collins. I'm assistant research, or associate research scientist at DRI and faculty science communication, and I am also strategic plan implementation lead in PR's office. Early in the strategic plan implementation process of the current, we identified a gap across NCHI where students at our state and community colleges had fewer workforce and career-focused opportunities than, say, upper-level undergrads. And we saw an opportunity to leverage the research environment at DRI to provide career-focused experiences through what we call the Research Corrosion Internship Program. This program launched in 2021 with a student-centered model. We have since provided 62 semester-long internships for students from multiple institutions, TMCC, GBC, CSM, Western Nevada College, and Nevada State University. When I say it's a student-centered model, we developed this program specifically to build career skills for students who's who are taking their first step in a STEM career. So there's a 4 to 5 week training period for every single intern working with a mentor. Students work in teams, resembles the real world, and they work towards a project deliverable or a task. And along the way, they focus on professional transferable skills while contributing to real research. Since 2021, 63% of our participants have been first-generation college students. And through our project evaluation, students have reported, 94% of our students have reported that their confidence working in STEM fields has increased. And likewise, 92% of the students increase their confidence solving problems using the tools provided by science. When students report on their experiences in this program, they're so positive, and they don't just touch on STEM, but the relationships that they build with their mentors, professional networks, because students are working in teams of other students from across the state, and numerous other benefits that we know are contributing to the STEM ecosystem here in Nevada. So this is a powerful program, and it's been funded by the MGM Foundation, Hearst Foundation, as well as other sources from NSF and NASA grants. So it's been very successful with our faculty as well. They include it in their proposal to fund, say, a team of students to work with them on projects. So we consider this to be a real success in the workforce development area. The next thing I want to talk about, next slide please, is the contribution that DRI makes to our graduate student workforce. You can see a graph here of graduate student participation at DRI. If you are not already aware, DRI faculty mentor and advise graduate students who are completing their degrees at UNLV and UNR. So our faculty compete for grants and contracts, which provide graduate student support for master's and PhD students. And those faculty, or those students, again, are involved in our immersive research environment. Those students, some of those students go on to be part of academic research careers, and a lot of them also go into other sectors, so private sector, government sectors, and NGOs. So we have a lot of students who work on hydrology topics, which we obviously know are crucial for our state, as well as atmospheric science, archaeology, and numerous other fields. With that, I'm going to pass it to my colleague, who's going to talk about some of our K through 12 contributions.
Hello, everybody. My name is Emily McDonald-Williams, and I'm the director of the STEM Education Program at DRI. So today I'm here to talk a little bit more about the STEM Education Program and how some of our initiatives advance workforce development within the state. These initiatives focus on predominantly pre-K through 12th grade STEM education, although we also have opportunities to engage educators to help support that workforce pipeline. We have workforce development direct programs, and we do a broad variety of community-based outreach. The first program I wanted to speak about was our Green Box program. So this is a pre-K through 12th grade curriculum kit. Green boxes are large green suitcases which contain 3 to 4 weeks of STEM-focused curriculum that is grade-specific and standards-aligned, as well as all of the supplies needed for a class of up to 40 students to engage in these hands-on activities. We developed the curriculum in-house with STEM workforce development in mind. All curriculum contains career connections to STEM-specific careers as well as career pathways. So students will be able to participate in these activities but also learn about the potential careers that they could potentially have. We highlight research scientists within this curriculum to help provide those real-world examples of careers that students could potentially have should they choose to follow these pathways. These kits reached over 30,000 students in the state of Nevada in 2024 alone, and are shipped quarterly to educators free of charge. We cover shipping to and from any school in the state. We ship these out 4 times a year. These have proven to be incredibly impactful mechanisms to engage students and educators in high quality and impactful STEM learning. And we hope to continue to utilize these as a tool to strengthen workforce development pathways within the state. In addition to that, all of our green boxes as well as education programs are accompanied by educator professional development trainings. These trainings are intended to increase K through 12th grade educators' competency, confidence, and knowledge of STEM topics and career pathways within the state. We predominantly host these trainings in Reno and Las Vegas, Nevada, although we do have virtual opportunities and we're beginning to conduct rural STEM educator professional development trainings. These 3.5-hour trainings provide educators with free resources, curriculum, and hands-on opportunities to practice implementing these activities to help increase their ability to provide that impactful STEM engagement within the classroom setting, helping to enhance the quantity and quality of STEM engagement that K through 12th grade students are having. It's been shown that increased engagement with STEM learning opportunities helps to pique student interest, increase their confidence in their own ability to do science or STEM-based topics, and therefore can help strengthen that STEM pipeline by increasing their interest and ability to engage with these topics in their youngest and most impactful years. Beyond that, we also have several workforce development programs that I hope to highlight today. The first of which was actually developed in partnership with the Southwest Innovation Engine Partnerships. Through those collaborations, DRI was able to bring the Chief Science Officer program to the state of Nevada. Chief Science Officers, or CSOs, is actually an international workforce development and STEM engagement program that began in the state of Arizona, where despite being international, Nevada had yet to have a chapter of the CSO program. This program engages middle and high school students in leadership development programming and training. Students from a variety of communities, schools, or local community organizations form small groups who are tasked with identifying and solving a problem within their community. These groups received in-depth training, public speaking opportunities, and they worked together to develop an impactful plan that meaningfully makes a difference within their community. This program started in the state of Nevada this year, and we are incredibly excited to see over 20 students express interest. And we're looking forward to continuing this impactful program within the state. Beyond that, we have a long-running program that we call STEMforce. STEMforce is a program that we've developed and implemented in partnership with the Help of Southern Nevada. This program works with youth who are located at the Shannon West Homeless Center who may be experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. These students come to DRI for an 8-week intensive STEM learning experience. During this time, they come to campus twice a day for 4 to 6 hours where they engage in hands-on STEM experiments, learning activities, and get to meet research scientists within the field. Each week, we focus on a different STEM topic, and we accompany these topics with local field trips, where these students are able to see STEM in action at different organizations throughout the community. The idea here is that they are introduced to these STEM careers, and they're able to tangibly see what it actually means to work within a STEM field in their own community. At the conclusion of this program, all participants are placed in paid internships in a STEM field of their in a STEM field that is identified with their area of interest. The idea here is to help strengthen that STEM pipeline, increase the competency of these students within STEM areas, which are shown to be typically higher paying, and provide them with opportunities to develop tangible work experience within the field. In addition, our final workforce development program is conducted in partnership with UNR, UNLV, and Nevada State University. This project provides undergraduate students with the opportunity to participate in a paid internship at a variety of schools throughout their local region. We pair together undergraduate students majoring in education with undergraduate students majoring in STEM. Through this opportunity, they're mentored through professional development and engagement with all institutions, and they work together to develop high-quality STEM activities within the classroom. This project has provided educators with a unique perspective of STEM in action, as well as provided the undergraduate students with a unique perspective of both the education system and a variety of different STEM majors. We're really excited to see this program continue, and the impact of it has been significant on all participants. Finally, I just wanted to show a little bit of our 2024 impact. Through our educator professional development trainings, we've impacted over 600 educators in 2024 alone. These 600 educators meet countless students every day, and if they implement the training that they were able to engage in, they have the opportunity to significantly advance student knowledge within the state. Through our community-based outreach programs, we've reached nearly 30,000 community members of all ages and impactful STEM learning and helping to share the resources and experiences going on in the state that's advancing STEM at a higher level. We've engaged over 33,000 K through 12th grade students in high quality and impactful STEM learning. And through our college level internship program, we've provided over 150 undergraduate students with the opportunity to advance their technical skills in both STEM and education fields. Just a brief look at the STEM education program. And now I would like to pass it on to my colleague, AJ Long, who is presenting from elsewhere today.
Hi, my name is AJ Long. I am the director of a program at DRI called Nevada Robotics. Our focus is increasing equity and access to computer science, innovation, engineering for students pre-K through college. We do this in a variety of ways. We are a team of educators, and we provide free statewide teacher training for teachers pre-K through college. We work with pre-service teachers at TMCC, GBC. We have worked with WNC in the past, as well as UNR. And we work with current educators who are working with our kids. In terms of sustainability, the best way to help our kids enter STEM careers is to start young and to train teachers. Because if we train and support teachers year after year, they will continue to upskill our kids. But we have to upskill the teachers first. Our program has grown from a team of one, just me as the educator, and now I have a team of 30. So we have 8 educators on our team, and I hire college kids from UNR, UNLV, and Nevada State University that help make all of this happen because we can't do it alone. Our program is funded through state funding, through federal funds, and through our partnerships with people like NV Energy and Nevada Gold Mines. We have offices. We are very fortunate to have offices here in Reno at DRI, in Las Vegas at DRI, and at Great Basin College. At those offices, we have robot and drone lending libraries that we'll talk about. But big picture is that we provide professional development, free resources, and we do a ton of community outreach and engagement. And at the end, I'll share a little bit of our impact. Next slide, please. One of our main programs is called METRICS. METRICS stands for Mentoring Educators Teaching Robotics and Innovation in Computer Science. If you can imagine a kindergarten teacher, they don't get into teaching kindergarten because they love robots and engineering. They get into teaching because they love kids. So our job is to train and support and upskill our educators so that they're prepared to train our kids how to work with technology for future jobs. Metrics is based in research in that we know that one training for a teacher is not enough to make change. So Metrics is a 3 or 4 day training experience over a semester. So if, for example, we go out to Elko and Spring Creek and do one training per month for 4 months. These trainings are 2.5 hours long. We provide a stipend to the teacher. We're paying them for their time. We feed them. We give them everything for free to remove all the barriers to learning. Because if you can imagine, robots and drones are expensive. So we do everything we can to support them to remove those barriers to reach kids in all parts of the state. Drones is another one of our current trainings. We've been providing drone teacher training. We have a partnership with the Mesquite Works STEAM Center. And so we did 2 teacher trainings this year, and we are co-hosting drone events all over the state. Nevada Robotics was the first organization to roll out drone competitions for Nevada. So last year we did 4, and this year we're doing more. We actually have a big event coming up on February 21st and 22nd at the GSR. That's in partnership with the JORTC high schools here. We have over 53 teams coming to compete on indoor drone competitions. Now, you may wonder, how does that relate to DRI? Well, a lot of our scientists use drones. Every business right now is using drones. This is a great workforce development skill for our students. So anything in terms of computer science and automation, manufacturing with the engineering piece is really a key skill for the future. Next slide, please. One unique program that we have current funding for is called Books and Bots. Back to my example of kindergarten teachers don't necessarily teach kindergarten because they love computer science, but we make them love it. We create lessons that tie robots to literacy, math, and coding, and then we train teachers how accessible it is to use robots as a teaching tool. Nevada Robotics started by supporting educators to create clubs and teams after school, which is great. We wanted to reach more, and as educators ourselves, we see that the key to that is tying computer science and coding to literacy and math so that it's just a tool and that all kids can have access to these wonderful schools, or wonderful skills. So our Books and Bots training, last fall we trained in Spring Creek, Elko, Wells, Ely, and Reno, and Mesquite, and this semester, we are doing teacher trainings in Winnemucca, Reno, and Vegas. We have reached over 900 teachers just in the last year. But our goal is to upskill our educators, and that creates confidence and gives them the skills that they need to provide these hands-on, engaging ways of teaching to our kids. Next slide, please. So that's a picture of our drone. That is an indoor drone, and behind it you can see the drone field. So when we talk about drone competitions, students learn to pilot these little drones, and they code these drones to fly through an obstacle course. These skills are essential for our future workforce to understand how we can do hands-on science that is applicable in so many fields. We provide free drones and free robots across the state. At our Reno, Elko, and Vegas offices, we also have a satellite campus at the Mesquite Work Center where teachers can check out robots and drones for free to use. Whether it's a quarter or a semester or over the summer for their programs, we are trying to remove those barriers. This is a really important program. Because of there are so many barriers, because it's very expensive. The college students that I hire are helping us with updating batteries and brains. Our college students are computer science students, engineering students, and education students. So not only are we upskilling teachers, we have this wonderful workforce development program where I pay these students to help us with trainings, but they also help us with all of the equipment. The other thing we provide for teachers in this lending library is a wish list. So after we do 3 or 4 trainings, teachers can request additional materials if they need them. If they need more robots, more books, more materials, we will do our best to provide them from the grants that we have. Next slide, please. Community outreach engagement. So one of the barriers to STEM careers are families, actually. There are families that feel like it's not accessible to them, and they transfer that to their kids. They might say, well, I was really bad at math, and I didn't like science. So part of our work is working with families to show them that it's accessible, engaging, and fun, and that they can do it. That's what we do with families and with children. So across the state, we help out and show up at STEM nights and do hands-on robotics, hands-on engineering, engaging families to show them that this is a possible career for their families moving forward. We work in every part of the state doing these events, especially when the teachers we train ask us to come help them. So we did the Nevada Day at the Springs, we do Earth Day. So this is kind of a statewide movement as well. We do partner with the Discovery Children's Museum. We partner with school districts. We partner with the Boys and Girls Club to kind of reach all areas of kids so we can have lots of seeds planted for growth. Last slide. In terms of our reach, we've actually exceeded 1,000 teachers right now to date in just 1 year, which reaches over 30,000 students. And these teachers don't just teach the robots and drones in class this year. They'll do it year after year after year. To date, we've distributed 12,000 books because of our Books and Bots program. We've engaged over 40,000 families. In terms of events, on average doing this during the school year, we're on the road training. We do about two events per week. So I will be in Oco and Spring Creek next week and Vegas the week after that. We are on the road traveling, reaching teachers. If you look at our rural reach, because of Nevada Gold Mines, we have so much potential and so much going on in the rurals. So if you look at, we've reached over 1,000 teachers, half of those are in the rurals. So we're really proud of our support out there, and GBC has been wonderful, so we're really grateful for our work that will hopefully continue. Thanks.
For the record, Vic Etienizian, DRI. Thank you very much, AJ and Emily and Megan, and thank you all very much for your attention. Happy to take any questions.
I'm constantly blown away by all things DRI, and so I just want to say thank you to Vic, AJ, Emily, and Megan for that presentation. I took a ton of notes. The three big things I wanted to highlight were you guys really hone in on the fact that today's learner is not a classroom lecture. It is hands-on learning. This is how our world is, and so you guys have already pivoted to this new learning style, and I think all these programs are absolutely incredible. And when we talk about wanting to diversify our economy, what you guys are doing in these programs and in the different facets, this is leading to that. I believe it was Emily, it might have been Megan, that mentioned funding and grant funding. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how, because we know that DRI is mostly funded by grants, so all of these incredible researchers and your staff have to go out and find money for the green boxes, find money for the STEM Force, the CSO, the paid internships, the Nevada Robotics. So what, and I guess second part of that, is it federal funding? Like, are we doing private funding? Like, do we have to be worried about any of these programs? And maybe it's too soon to know, but it is just something that is in top of mind. So please.
Maybe I'll ask Emily to answer the first question, then move on to AJ.
Yeah, so Emily McDonald-Williams for the record. That's a great question. So for the STEM education program, currently we have federal funding, state grant funding, foundation funding, and then we also get philanthropic donations. So our funding is relatively diversified. We do currently have a large amount of federal funding, so there is the potential for impact there. I will say each program is funded through different sources, so I'm happy to provide more information about any specific program's funding levels, but it is through a multitude of sources.
Would you say, so would you go out and find grants for your specific program? Is that how this works? Each of these STEM Force, like whoever's in charge of STEM Force, do they go out and find the funding for that? Or is there a holistic bucket that you're saying, hey, for the workforce STEM programs that we do, everybody's kind of adding money to the bucket? What's the structure like?
That's a great question. So that also varies based upon the program itself. So for example, our Green Box program is funded through a wide variety of different funders. And oftentimes the grants that we're seeking fund multiple things. So a portion of that grant funding will go to the Green Boxes, a portion will go to educator professional development, and a portion may go to workforce development. Currently, the STEMForce program, for example, is funded by two different private funders. One of them is a foundation and one of them is a contract. So it really varies program to program. I will say my team does work very interdisciplinary. So oftentimes I'll see team members, one who runs educator professional development, working with the one who runs the Green Box program to apply collaboratively for grant funding to support both of those initiatives.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Thank you for that.
Of course.
And I think.
AJ, do you want to address how robotics is funded?
Sure, thanks. AJ Wong, for the record. So Nevada Robotics was originally established with funding from the Tesla Education Investment and Nevada Gold Mines, with the intent that we need to have robotics teams at every school in the state. Since then, we have not only do we do teacher training, we are spending tons of time writing grants, working on relationships with industry partners. So we have grants and gifts from Aero Electronics, from NV Energy. We have a state grant that's a literacy and innovation grant, so that's a one-year grant, and then we do have federal funds. Our drone program is federally funded, and we're hoping that that stays in place. It's a challenge, so thank you for asking and bringing it to the attention to everyone, because our program is 100% self-funded. So if we don't get funding, the program goes away, we all lose our jobs. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure, and any support, and I think partnerships are key, right? We are partnering with other people on grants, and I think that's kind of where the magic lies. Thanks.
Well, fact that you guys do all this incredible work and it is self-funded, it's just so many accolades and kudos I could send to every single person at DRI for continuing this great work. As an aside, the head of the robotics club, I don't know, it's a meetup group, I know him, he actually messaged me after I sent him your slide yesterday, and he'd love to connect with you. So I'll make sure I help
Sounds
with
good.
That. He used to run robotics at Panasonic, so he's got some credentials.
Great.
I'll help you out.
Perfect.
There. I'm happy to make that
Thank
intro.
You.
I got excited about that because he literally just wrote me back. But, I was going to say, I love to hear that the mining institutions are still such big help. Nevada's first STEM. It's an important thing to know. I'm going to turn it over to Regent Brager and then Regent Del Carlo.
Nothing against our other systems, but nothing is more energizing than listening to DRI and all that you do. And every time that we sit and hear the magnitude of the future, and what's interesting is that it excites students because they live in a different world than just academia. The outside interest that they can gain from the robotics and all the things that you do, hydroponics, water resources, it's amazing. And I think letting different schools know that you're there. Some of our, private campuses that are small. I'm going to be visiting with the Nasri Academy probably in April now due to busy schedules. But these are gifted children of a whole campus that you would open up their world. And so I just want to tell you thank you again. There's not enough words to express how stimulating and energizing that you are when I'm able to listen to anything that you do. So I just look forward to more things happening and through workforce development, and I'm glad to be on the committee with amazing leadership. And she's so driven, it just it helps all of us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Regent Del Carlo.
Okay, hi, Don. Mute. Oh, I agree with my two colleagues. I'm always blown away by DRI and all the wonderful things you guys are doing. And I knew all about the Green Boxes, but I have to be honest, I did not know about Nevada Robotics with you guys, the metrics, the books, and the bots. And you guys are way ahead of the curve. And it's really a shame that this isn't just required all through K through 12 because our kids would be so much more ahead. And I was very concerned. Chair Brown really brought it up on how you were funded, because I know I'm in an organization in my community that we helped fund a green box one year. And although 30,000 is wonderful, I looked it up, and in 2022, there was 447,603 K through 12 students in Nevada. So we're only even touching 6.7% of students in our state with the green boxes. And I love the green boxes. So I guess one of my questions to you guys is, how can we help? I was sitting here thinking, it's all grant funded. You're raising money. Would you guys be willing to do like, what do they call it? Those giving days, where it can go out to everybody in Enchi and all your, you know, probably thousands of people that you have on your email list and stuff, to have a giving day. I mean, sometimes that brings in, can bring up close to $1 million once or twice a year. I mean, I would love to see that. I mean, and all the different organizations. I know it's a lot of work to go out to all the different nonprofit organizations for help, but what you're doing is game-changing for our students. And I'm an old dinosaur, let's face it, at my age, I didn't grow up with any of this stuff. So I'd love to come see some of that competition where they're learning to fly the drone and then go through the little obstacle course. I think that would be wonderful to, even if you could come do an example for the whole Board of Regents, because, you know, we're not up to all this technology. At least I know I'm not. I'm not speaking for all 13, but I know that would be an amazing thing, maybe at a future meeting or something, that we could have some demonstrations. So I just really applaud your work. You're cutting edge, and you need to be mainstream. And the faster we can get there and help you guys do that, the better. And you guys have a great leader sitting there, President Achara, and every one of your team members is just so dedicated and passionate about what they do, and I just applaud all of your wonderful work. So keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say thanks. This is AJ. I just want to say thank you, and yes, we'd be happy to bring robots and drones, and we can all have a little play day. But it is important for you to engage with what we can give to our kids, because that's part of it. So we're happy to do that.
Thank you. This is Emily McDonald Williams. We really appreciate your support, and I echo what AJ said. We're always happy to come to your meetings and provide demonstrations or any further information. I also wanted to address your initial point about a giving campaign and just note that DRI has a wonderful foundation who helps support our philanthropic efforts. We're actively engaging with them to support the development of those types of efforts to help further support our education program. So I appreciate that you brought that up, and we're actively looking into it. So thank you.
Is anybody else on the committee have a comment before I go to the other regents? All right, before I turn it over, I just want to say, first of all, March 27th is the DRI Day at the Legislature, so you can get a little taste of DRI. And last year I was able to do the simulation. I did okay. I'm not great. I don't have a future in this, but, you know, working knowledge is important. I do want to highlight this paid internship thing again, because I just love the idea of that's two different sides. As someone who's tried to take coding classes and not done great, that is two different sides of your brain, and then getting them to work and understand how they interact with education and STEM in the same work field, and then creating the programs that will go into the classroom. I think this is really special. I like to joke that I'm the MySpace generation that had to code my own web page because, you know, I needed the pink sparkles, but that is the extent of my coding experience. But I think this is really special that you're actively, you know, investing in the students at the undergrad level to work together and get their brains thinking. Also, just to highlight, the train-the-trainer model is so important, and it's something that so many people ignore because they want to fund the program, but then you're not actually setting the teacher up for success. But you guys have thought about that, and it seems like you have multiple layers here where that's happening. So I also just wanted to highlight that. I'm going to turn it over to Regent Boylan.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Great presentations, great information, but actually Regent Brager already mentioned what was on my mind, so I don't have much to say except I think it was AJ or JJ, the lady. With all this training you do for the K through 12 teachers in robotics and such, aren't you afraid that they'll leave their little, wee little children and go off into robotics? Don't give them too much training. That's just a compliment, actually. But thank you for all of DRI. I appreciate what you guys do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Are there any more questions or comments from Regents? Yes, Regent Del Carlo, I did say March 27th for DRI. It's DRI and CSN day at the same day. So it's a 2-for-1. All right, well, I just want to say thank you. I know I'm a
bit... Chair, excuse me.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. I need to get your text number in here so I can get a
I got you.
Thank you. But, you know, definitely my years in the legislature, I have to say DRI is probably one of the best-kept secrets in the state of Nevada. But, yeah, and, you know, just some of the conversations I'm hearing coming out of the legislature right now, they're going to need some help and support. I'm very concerned about where this federal funding could go, will go, might go, and we as regents, you know, again, they're probably the best program we got going right now, and they're going to need some help. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more, Regent Gogachia. I also want to just let you know that we're not allowed to say that DRI is the best kept secret in Nevada anymore because we're supposed to be ambassadors for it. I got in trouble with, I corrected myself after my first time saying it. DRI is amazing, and we are going to just keep amplifying everything they do because they're not a secret. They're clearly having such a great impact in our state. But I echo your concern with the funding sources because we want to make sure that they can continue to do this. You know, I brought up diversifying our economy. This is just one of the ways that our, as a system, this is happening. This is like layered on top of all the research that you're doing and all the impact you're making in the world beyond just helping our students, but it's building that pipeline to make sure that we have strong researchers and people who are curious and people who are asking good questions and making us a more educated, thoughtful community. And so much of this will lead to that. This isn't just about, you know, the classroom experience. It's how that's going to compound over the 12 years that they're in school, plus then higher ed, plus then hopefully into the workforce, into a STEM field that will bring high-paying, sustainable, great jobs to Southern Nevada and make us more of a robust, a diverse economy. So I think there's so much to this. So to your point, Regent Gogachia, we do need to help them make sure that they are stable in their funding. Having said that, are there any more comments? If not, thank you so much, DRI, for coming up. And we love hearing it. I took a ton of notes, and AJ, I will 100% be connecting you with my contact because he's excited. So,
thank you, and thank you for your support.
Thank you. All right, we are going into new business. Does any regent have any new business agenda items? Seeing none, we're going to move to public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is not.
Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
Not seeing any.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? SES, is there any public comment on the phones?
There are no callers at this time, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you so much. And with that, I call this meeting of the Workforce Committee closed at 10:40.
Thank you, Madam Chair.